In two parts on the program today, thoughts on the Trump economic agenda from his Secretary of the Treasury, Steven Mnuchin. Straight ahead from American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday today, the 27th of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I took a little ride last night out to the west side of L.A., fought the traffic and rush hour, the whole deal, but it was worth it. A conversation with Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin at the Buerkle Center for International Relations at UCLA. Me and the secretary on stage, 300 or so people in the audience, as you will hear from the hissing and the booing and the applause. Secretary Mnuchin made some opening remarks about the new tax law and new North Korea sanctions that have been put into place, and then he and I got going.
So, first of all, thank you all for coming. I appreciate you taking the time on this afternoon. Mr. Secretary, thank you also for your time. Let me ask you a kind of a framing question here. There was a story I read in researching this talking about you being the finance chairman for the Trump campaign.
Yes.
And people were saying, Steve, why are you doing this? What? And you said, look, if this works out, nobody's going to ask me why I was doing this. So the question is, how's it working out for you?
No, actually, the question was slightly different, okay? And let me first say, I consider it a great honor to serve the country.
Yep.
So. I think we live in a democracy. We're lucky to live in this country. We're lucky to have differences of opinions. And for me, I was never involved really in politics. Some people spend their entire life in politics. I recognized that there were certain issues that were in this country, and that's why I participated in the campaign. So, that's why I'm here.
What was it about the president's approach to the American economy that made you say, I want to work for this guy? That's a good point.
No, I think they're going to get more tired than I am. So, you know, that's kind of that chance. Oh, yeah, I'm dealing with students. I forgot. There's a lot of students. So
what was it about the president's economic agenda that made you say, I want to do this and work on this?
Look, I go back to the comment of, you know, the financial crisis impacted lots of people. I operated banks that went under during the financial crisis. I saw the impact of what went on and how important banks are to local communities and the economic issues, and I felt an obligation to try to do things that would help people and help the economy, and particularly the middle class. And I think we're very proud of these accomplishments.
So we'll get to that in a minute. We'll get to the tax bill and all that in a minute. But I want to talk about the last section of your remarks here about the sanctions that you were in charge of and responsible for, specifically the North Korean sanctions that were announced on Friday,
yes,
the new round. Sanctions, as you know, take years and decades to play out. The question is, do you, and more particularly, the president, have the patience to let them play out with North Korea?
Well, I'm not going to comment on kind of what we're going to do going forward and what patience we have and what patience we don't have, but I don't agree with you on your premise. So
that they take decades?
Yeah, I don't
agree
with that.
North Korea's been under sanction for decades, sir. Iran's been under sanction for decades.
It
is true.
Okay, well, let me give you the facts.
Sure.
Because this we can have a debate about.
Sure.
Okay. There's 500 sanctions on North Korea since 2005. Basically, half of them been done in the last year. We have more sanctions authority now than we've ever had before. So, for example, we have now powers that we can sanction anybody who's doing trade with North Korea. So I would, in all disrespect, I would say, all respect, I would say that that these things take some time, but it is not decades, and we've seen evidence that they are already having an impact. But let me also make a comment. Our issue is not with the people of North Korea, so we want to be careful that we're not doing things. There are things that we could sanction that impact the people. What we're trying to do is cut down his ability to do ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons.
And you're satisfied that these sanctions you announced on Friday are tightening the noose?
Again, absolutely. So what we started with was illegal ship-to-ship transfers. These are very granular. We now have identified ships that are violating UN sanctions, and these ships will be prevented from doing this again. We've also put out Coast Guard advisories. We're working with the Navy. This is a full effort across the government.
As you know, Ivanka Trump was in South Korea.
Yes.
For the Olympic delegation. She also, as you know, briefed the South Korean president, President Moon, on these sanctions. Given that she's a family member of the president without a permanent security clearance, do you think that was appropriate?
I absolutely think it was appropriate.
How so?
Again, she's an assistant to the president. She didn't travel as a family member. She traveled as assistant to the president. I briefed her. You're not aware of what security clearance is needed one way or another for these things. And again, I'm very comfortable with what she did representing the country on a very important issue, I might add.
There was a little audience Q&A last night as well, during which there was a question about Russia sanctions and why there haven't been any by the White House, even after Congress gave the administration authority to do so last summer. Here's what Secretary had to say about that.
Congress, in one of the overwhelming 98-2 in the Senate, I can't remember the last time anything passed 98-2 in the Senate, just passed the CATSA legislation. I'm actually going to brief Congress tomorrow on this. I've testified. You can go look at my test. We manage these things. So I can tell you, and the White House, the press conference on Friday, I said the same thing. You can expect sanctions will be coming in the next 30 days. It's a very complicated process, but I can assure you in Treasury, because we are responsible for this, we are enforcing all the existing sanctions and putting more in place.
Let me pick up on something you just said, sir. Within 30 days. We'll hear Russian sanctions from you?
Yes.
30 days from last night, 28th of March, I believe. Mark your calendars. We'll keep an eye on that one as well. More to come later in the program from the Secretary, trade, the tax law, and Dodd-Frank. Elsewhere in American capitalism today, Jay Powell went to Capitol Hill for his first congressional testimony this morning as Fed chair. TLDR on that one? Economy's fine. Good. Even interest rates are going to keep going up. Thus, cue the sad music. We will have the details when we do the numbers. There's automotive news out of Germany today that's kind of a biggie. A top German court said cities there can now ban older diesel vehicles if those cities have high pollution levels. Back before Volkswagen's emissions cheating scandal a couple of years ago, more than half of the new cars sold in Europe had diesel engines. They have been losing market share ever since, and today's ruling is only going to hasten the decline of diesel. Bad news for German automakers and those diesel car owners as well, as Marketplace's Aaron Schrank reports.
There are 15 million diesel vehicles on Germany's roads, most of them heavy emitters of nitrogen oxide, which can cause breathing problems. Last year, 70 German cities exceeded European Union limits for nitrogen oxide. Bans are one way to get that under control, but auto industry consultant Marianne Keller says today's ruling could hurt millions of motorists.
The value of every car on the road has just diminished. Who's going to buy it and what are they going to pay for it if they now know that that car has a limited life expectancy on the road?
Keller says some jurisdictions might raise diesel fuel costs with more taxes or do things like mandate diesel cars can't enter city centers during rush hour.
Whatever the means are, it will immediately change the percentage of cars bought in Europe that are diesel powered.
It would cost automakers an estimated $18 billion to upgrade older diesel cars. Keller says it's probably smarter to just get these vehicles off the road. She says some local governments will likely pressure car makers to participate in buyback schemes. Petroleum analyst Dan McTagg at GasBuddy.com says the decision certainly clouds diesel's future, but not that much.
It is the fuel on which the world economy runs and hums. And that, of course, may change, but it certainly won't change overnight, and it certainly won't change because of one particular jurisdictional court decision.
But German automakers are central to the sector across Europe, so the court decision is likely to have repercussions. Paris and Madrid have pledged to ban diesel vehicles from city centers by 2025. Just hours after today's German court ruling, the city of Hamburg said it would begin limiting diesel vehicles in April. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
I say commercial real estate, you most likely think, what, big urban skyscrapers or maybe an office park or strip mall out in the suburbs somewhere, right? Yeah, that does work, but there is a corner of that industry that's been pretty hot the past couple of years. Investment in student housing, university and college student housing, nearly tripled from 2014 to 2016, and it is still growing strong. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has that one.
Forget the old on-campus cinder block dorms with perpetually sticky floors and the subtle, maybe not so subtle odor of last night's party. These are modern shared apartments in mostly off-campus buildings that rent by the bed. Ryan Lang is with ARA Newmark, a broker for student housing complexes across the country.
We just sold a $55 million asset at the University of Florida in Gainesville with modernized interiors. It actually had garages that were attached to the units, and one of the amenities that they had on site was a lazy river.
Yep, he just said lazy river. Transaction volumes for student housing peaked in 2016 at $10 billion. They were a bit lower last year, but so far, Lang says demand in 2018 has been strong. One reason, student housing is seen as recession-proof, or at least recession-resilient. When jobs are scarce, people go back to school or stay in school longer. Another reason is interest from foreign investors.
Back in 2014, only 2% of all student housing deals involved cross-border investors.
Jim Costello with Real Capital Analytics.
That jumped to 36% of those groups by 2017.
There are more investors interested in buying student housing than there are properties for sale, says Jacqueline Fitz, director of student housing at CBRE. But actually, for students, it's not such a bad deal.
You look at these amenity-rich complexes off-campus versus the on-campus housing, and you assume that they would be a lot more expensive, but they're not. Surprisingly, the costs are very similar.
As long as that fancy pool doesn't distract too much from the studying. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Coming up, some more from Secretary Mnuchin, and then a little bit of this.
It's a myth that people can immigrate here quickly based on family relationships. In many cases, they absolutely cannot.
The long and expensive immigration wait. But first, let's do the numbers. Man, I had this one for the wah-wah trombones. I don't know. Dow Industrial's off 299 points today, 1.1%, closed at 25,410 once again. I don't pick the music. The NASDAQ down 91 points, about 1.2%, finished at 7330. The S&P 500 gave back 35 points, also 1.2%, 27.44 there. So, Fed Chair Powell and interest rates we talked about, he also indicated support for a proposal in Congress to increase the size of banks that would then be subject to stricter oversight. So you have JPMorgan Chase off 1.1% today. Bank of America trickled down about 0.2%. Channel changer in the broadcast world. Comcast made a bid for the British broadcaster Sky for about $30 billion. Comcast down 7.3% today. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Back to UCLA we go, the Buerkle Center for International Relations, and my conversation last night with Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin. We did sanctions earlier in the program, now trade, the new tax law, and the rest of the economy. Remember, as you hear this, it was a live, in-person, and very not quiet audience.
Let me take it to the tax law.
Yes.
That you and the president and the Congress passed last year. The president signed it. It took effect on the 1st of January, as you know. During your confirmation hearings, you said whatever tax reform the Trump administration is going to work on will not add to the debt and the deficit.
It's true, and I stand behind that.
Sir, the tax bill that's in force now adds $1.5 trillion to the deficit.
No, that's not the case. The tax bill scored on a static basis adds $1.5 trillion. Let me just go through the numbers.
Yes, sir.
There's $500 billion difference between what's called baseline and policy. Those are things that were going to be extended anyway. That takes the number down to $1 trillion. We believe that with 90 basis points of growth, there'll be over $2
trillion. Why don't you explain what 90 basis points means?
90 basis points of GDP. So GDP going from basically 2.1% to 3%.
So in other words, 0.3% on growth.
That's correct.
Okay. The catch, of course, is, and as you know, you did have two quarters of 3% economic growth this past year, but year-over-year growth in the American economy was 2.3%.
That's right. That's
so,
why
so
we're
still
doing
far
all these
away
things.
From target, right?
Absolutely. That's why we're doing all these things. So these things have some impact, and all of our economic plans are about creating sustained economic growth.
Help me understand then with some specificity how you're going to do that. Because the numbers that were engineered by the White House and the Council of Economic Advisors that went into the tax plan were we're going to get 3%, here's how, as opposed to these are our policies, which is going to get us to 3%.
Well, you must seem to have a bias because you're using the words engineered. So you obviously think that it was the policies were created. Again, what I would say is we fundamentally believe that we will have economic growth. And again, 35 basis points is the break-even. And we're already seeing this. By the way, we're seeing companies give millions and millions of workers bonuses, all as a result of this. And for people who are getting these $1,000 bonuses, these are not crumbs.
Absolutely not, and I'm not going to imply that at all. You said 4 million workers in this economy?
4.5 million.
4.5 million have gotten one-time bonuses, right?
Yes.
So this is a labor pool of 155 million people, sir.
Yeah, so are you, for those four and a half million workers...
So my question is...
In 1 month, that's a big deal. That's a big deal. 4.5 million workers have already seen this impact.
By some estimates, it's about two... these Americans
for
tax
reform... Well, you can do the... I understand you're doing the math.
No. So the American for tax reform, say, plus or minus, 86 companies have given wage increases, 250 companies have given one-time bonuses. And I guess the question is, what would you rather have? Would you rather have a one-time bonus or a consistent wage increase over the next couple of years?
We fundamentally believe that there will be wage increases going through the workers.
Why do you believe that?
Again, I just went through why we believe it. It's a function of economic policy. It's a function of making a more competitive system that companies can invest. And again, there's research that 70% of the tax burden is borne by the workers. So this is all about making a more competitive U.S. system for jobs. Thank you.
So let me ask you about something you said about 10 days, 2 weeks ago, that after the president said at Davos, you know what, we might get into the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the Obama-negotiated deal that President Trump pulled us out of early in his administration. President said, you know, I might be able to get back into that. If we could work out a way that's advantageous. And then you said the other day the president and his administration would be willing to go, and these are your words, go multilateral. That deal is going to be signed and done on the 8th of March, sir. So what interest do you think the other Trans-Pacific Partnership
I think they have a lot of interest. I've met with them a lot recently, and to the extent that they are absolutely willing to have discussions with the United States if that's something we want to pursue.
And you fully expect that they will let America back into the TPP?
Again, it's not a question of letting us back in or not letting us back
in. Well, the president pulled us out, sir.
Again, what I would say is they're interested in us being in agreement. Right now, the president, okay, is more focused on bilateral trades, and that's our priority, and that's what we're negotiating. What the president has said is, kind of when we get done with the bilaterals that we're focused on, to the extent that kind of the TPP will change, we will consider, not a question of whether they will let us back in, we will consider whether we want to go into the multilateral agreement.
That sounds very much like, and I apologize for characterizing your words, but it sounds very much like you're saying we will deign to have a conversation with them in which they might be allowed to trade with us.
That's not what I said. So again, let's just be clear. The United States is the largest trading market in the world.
Absolutely.
Everybody wants to do business in the United States. The United States has the lowest tariffs, has the lowest barriers. Every single country wants to do business in the United States. And, by the way, to the extent that we can do business with other countries on the exact same terms, okay, and our companies can be treated the exact same way, we believe in reciprocal free trade. So that's our objective.
One of the things the president has said and his advisors have said is, listen, we need to fix regulation in this country, financial regulation. The Dodd-Frank financial reform law is too strict. We need to loosen it up a little bit. Brian Moynihan, the CEO of B of A, said the other day, Dodd-Frank's fine. What are we doing?
Yeah, you know why? Okay, because the top eight banks control all the assets in the United States, and they don't want anybody else to compete. So what we're trying to do, and by the way, there is bipartisan support for this, and I think this legislation will be passed in the next 3 months, to modify Dodd-Frank so that commercial banks, regional banks, community banks can succeed. Our objective is we don't want just eight large banks in the United States. So the modifications on Dodd-Frank are all designed to help community banks and regional banks.
Even though community banks are making record profits this past year?
Again, that's because the economy is doing better. But yes, do you want them all to be gobbled up by Brian Moynihan? No, we want to make sure that we have a healthy, broad-based banking system.
Mr. Secretary, thank you for your time, and thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks, sir. Okay,
thank you. Thank you, everyone.
One of the things Secretary Mnuchin and I didn't get to last night was immigration and the changes the White House wants to make in how people are allowed to come to this country, emphasizing skills over family ties. Family reunification, it is sometimes called, now more frequently by Republicans, chain migration. The argument that President Trump and the GOP make is that a single legal immigrant can quickly and easily bring in a nearly unlimited number of relatives who, the theory goes, then create a drain on the economy. But as Marketplace's Rima Kreis explains, there is very little that is quick or easy about it.
Ella and her daughter Iris spend pretty much every minute together.
Every waking moment.
On a recent afternoon, after running errands, they made their way back to their Los Angeles apartment holding hands.
Come on, baby.
They were even dressed in the same outfit, bold cheetah prints.
Yes, we try to coordinate every Sunday.
Iris was born with a rare genetic disorder known as Apert syndrome. It's left her permanently disabled and unable to care for herself.
She's 35 now, but she is mentally evaluated as between 6 and 7.
Ella, we're only using her first name, brought Iris here from the Philippines in 1991 when she was 9, so she could be treated by specialists. She remembers the day she said goodbye to her three other small children who stayed behind with family.
I promised my children, my God, don't worry, I'll be back. I thought all in all, it will just take a year.
But Iris needed multiple surgeries, so they stayed. Ella got a job as an insurance agent. She started volunteering at the local church. She met her future husband there. And when she got her green card in 2012, she filed a petition to bring her son and two daughters to Los Angeles.
Imagine all the important moments that I have missed, you know, their birthdays, Christmases, First Communion.
Their college graduations. And Ella's children are still waiting, along with 4 million other would-be immigrants around the world.
It's a myth that people can immigrate here quickly based on family relationships. In many cases, they absolutely cannot.
Susan Cohen is an immigration lawyer with Mintz Levin. She says there's an overall cap on the number of relatives who can come to the U.S. in any given year. And the wait, depending on where you're from and how you're related, can be epic.
The wait times can vary from none to, you know, like 22 or 25 years.
Had Ella become a citizen while her kids were still young, they might have been here in a year. But once children turn 21, they are pushed to the back of the line, which could mean a decade or more. And if they're married and trying to come from the Philippines, which has a huge backlog, 2 decades.
It's an extremely long waiting period. A huge amount of things can change in that amount of time.
Ella's children are now in their 30s and have children of their own, but they've held off getting married to keep their place in line. And the wait isn't the only challenge. Just putting the process in motion can cost petitioners thousands of dollars in legal fees. They also have to prove they can support their relatives when they get here, says Jennifer Hunt, an economics professor at Rutgers.
They need to submit their tax returns to show that they're earning over 125% of the poverty line.
She says petitioners are financially responsible for a relative for up to 10 years. Roughly 2/3 of people who come to the U.S. legally each year do it through family migration. But Hunt says there's little hard data on how the economic lives of those immigrants take shape once they get here, what type of work they do, how long they stay.
It's really quite shocking, actually, how little we know even about the administrative data that, you know, must be somewhere.
What Ella thinks she knows is that her college-educated children will have better job opportunities here and will be able to earn more. And that is worth even 6 more years of waiting. She'll be 73 by then, and she says she'd like someone to look after her and after Iris. In Los Angeles, I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today. As I mentioned, Fed Chair Powell made his first appearance before Congress today in his new capacity. And really, there was a whole lot he said that could have been said by his predecessor, Janet Yellen. We put together a Who Said It? Yellen or Powell game on our website, marketplace.org. A warning here, it is harder than you think. Also, at one point, without even asking me if he could use my line, Chair Powell said this.
I think the general thing is the stock market is not the economy, but it's a factor.
You can't see me, but I am kind of dropping the mic right now. All right, we got to go. Red all over the place on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials off 299 points, 1.1%. NASDAQ off 91, 1.2%. S&P 500 dropped 35 points, also 1.2%. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Ben Hethcote does digital video for us. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Zatar Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.